This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In the not-so-distant future, crimes are punishable by color. Writer Hillary Jordan has created a fictional world where felons are put through a process called chroming. Their skin is genetically pigmented to fit their crimes. So petty crimes are punished with yellow chroming, blue skin for sex offenders, and red is reserved for convicted murderers. Hannah Payne is a red. She is the protagonist of Hillary Jordan's new book, When She Wrote. And I don't know what the crime is for not being on the phone when we're ready to talk with you or what color it is. But in fact, that would be the color now. Hillary Jordan is on the line with us now. Have we gotten through? Hello, Hillary.
We have.
Oh, what a pleasure to talk with you.
Nice to talk to you.
I want to start by talking to you, asking you to describe the America that this book is set in. Separation of church and state has all but been eliminated. How does that play out in this book?
It plays out, you know, separation of church and state has been eliminated. There was a kind of plague that for about 7 years made women infertile. So abortion has been made illegal in all but a handful of states. Government surveillance is, you know, pretty operative. There's not a lot of privacy of individuals. So it's kind of a scary right-wing America.
Many elements of this fictional future are familiar already. Not everything has changed, but criminals are stigmatized in a new way. What does it mean to be chromed?
Yes. So instead of, it's been decided that keeping prisoners in jail is too expensive. And so all but the most violent criminals are released and their skin is turned a bright color depending on their crime. Murder is, if you commit murder, you're red. If you molest a child, you're a blue, et cetera. And so essentially you're stigmatized and targeted once you're released into the public.
And we should mention that reality TV plays a part in this penal system. How does this form of entertainment fit into the criminal justice system?
Well, you know, my book is a riff on The Scarlet Letter, and Hester Prynne begins the book by standing in front of, on a scaffold, in front of the entire community of Boston in the 1680s. And in sort of creating this world, I was thinking what would be the modern or slightly futuristic equivalent of a scaffold, and it would be reality television, which then is used to film prisoners while for the 30 days that they are in the chrome ward.
And that's and that is entertainment, and people watch.
Yes, they do.
And, you know, that's not so hard to believe either. Somehow,
no, it really
scary,
isn't, right?
Scarily, I have to say. And of course, religion. I mean, you talked about this being a very sort of right-wing idea of nationhood. Religion plays an awful important part in, as you say, a riff on The Scarlet Letter as well.
Yes, and there's now a Secretary of Faith, which is not to say that the entire country is Christian. Obviously, people still have their various faiths, but there is a Christian Secretary of Faith, and that really really does shape a lot of government policy.
Now, the book's protagonist is Hannah Payne. She
yes.
wakes up in a cell with her skin red at the start of the novel. The narrative is written from her perspective. Tell us about that. How did Hannah find herself in the correction system?
Well, Hannah, much like Hester, had an affair with a preacher. And unlike Hester, however, Hannah decided to have an abortion, which is illegal in the state of Texas in my near future, and was caught and therefore sentenced to be a red for 10 years. But because she refused to name the abortionist or the child's father, her sentence was extended to 16 years. So she's got a pretty dreadful 16 years coming up when the book opens.
Now, Hannah had the abortion, but that does not make her in any sense a rebel. She was utterly conformed to the religious context in which she was born.
Yes, she was raised as an evangelical Christian, grew up, you know, very much with those beliefs. And so the abortion for her is an incredibly traumatic thing that she does out of desperation. So in that sense, the book really shows both sides of the abortion issue. I really wanted to look at it from all sides and to show the agony of it for people.
And she did refuse to implicate the abortionist and the father, and or the prospective father, who was Aidan Dale. Tell us about him.
Well, Aidan Dale is my analog of Arthur Dimmesdale. He is the he began as her pastor, a megachurch preacher of a 20,000-member church in Plano, Texas, and rose to become the Secretary of Faith. But during their affair, he was her pastor.
And she's doing this to protect him, obviously.
And she's doing this to protect him because he's a married man, and she doesn't want to ruin his career. There are, in my future, also paternal rights that force you to name the father of the child. So she would have to reveal him, and she doesn't want to do it.
And right away, we see the conflict, the conflicting loyalties, philosophical and even spiritual and religious loyalties in terms of her action, what she does to have the abortion in the first place and then to protect the man, all of which to protect a reputation of somebody who is upholding the very Christian principles that have put her in jail.
Yes, exactly.
So the story is inspired, as you said, by Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter. You used the word and the analog. How do you do this? In the writing process, you have a body of ideas, characters with their own lives, but you're very clearly and openly writing this analog.
The Scarlet Letter was more of a jumping off point for me because the opening is similar, but the book really does go in a very different place. I mean, Hester Prynne accepts her sentence and lives out her days in Boston wearing her Scarlet A. In Hannah's case, my protagonist's case, she goes off on a set of adventures and ends up essentially running for her life. So I borrowed from the Scarlet Letter, but it is by no means, you know, a roadmap for me.
Right.
My book goes somewhere else.
Did you see that right from the beginning? Well, how did these ideas come to you initially?
Well, the initial idea for the book had nothing to do with the Scarlet Letter. It had to do with this idea of turning people of color as punishment. And it came from a conversation I had with my uncle many, many years ago about the drug problem in America. And he said, well, I think all drugs ought to be legal, but they just ought to turn you bright blue so that other people can see you coming and stay the hell away from you. And this idea of what it would be like to be stigmatized in such a way really stuck in my mind. And then many years later, I wrote 4 pages about a woman who had been turned red for killing someone who wakes up in a prison cell. And that's all I had initially.
And then you develop these other ideas, and of course, we're talking about the 17th century Puritanical Society of the Scarlet Letter. How much of that do you think has that re-evolved? Has it re-emerged? Has that always been a part of the American culture?
I think we have always had these conflicting desires towards impulses towards freedom on the one hand, and this sort of fear and turning inward on the other. And I think we've gone through many cycles of this. You know, the Puritans wanted to make a paradise, but the first thing they built was a prison, you know. And I think we're still seeing this conflict. I think we're in a wave of it right now that we entered post 9/11. And that's when I came back to those 4 pages, was post 9/11. And so the book is very much a reaction to a lot of the muddying of church and state that we've seen, and, you know, the government intrusion into people's lives in the name of national security, and the attacks on women's reproductive freedom, and all that has happened.
I wonder what you think of this theory. I've been seeing more and more about this notion of zombie economics, the idea that we have somehow taken the soul out of our economic activity, our economic behavior is soulless and mindless, and then in a way compensated for that in other moralities and become hyper-moral when it comes to sexual and other behaviors, and that's where we sort of project our demons as we abuse people economically.
I think it comes in cycles, and you know, it's in the American character to eventually do the right thing. You know, we got rid of Jim Crow, we got rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but we struggled really hard on the way to doing that. But I do believe that, you know, the fundamentalist agenda certainly is doomed to fail because it's fundamentally un-American. We like our freedom. And we do struggle, and we do go through these phases, but I don't believe that my bleak future is going to come to pass.
Hannah has her journey. She's on her way to Canada and is led along the way by a cast of characters. Tell us a little bit about the journey and the people she meets.
Well, she is Hannah is targeted by this group called the Fist of Christ. Her brother-in-law, who hates her, is a member of it. And as they are about to, they're a vigilante group, and as they are about to capture her and her friend, she is rescued by another group calling themselves the Novembrists, who are sort of defending women's reproductive freedom. And because she's been chrome for having an abortion, they are willing to try to put her on a sort of underground railroad and lead her to Canada, where this can be reversed. And that's her. That's really her quest in the book. But I mean, that's the physical quest. But there's also the book is called When She Woke, and it's about many different kinds of awakenings: sexual, spiritual, philosophical, intellectual, all of it.
When She Woke is set in your native Texas. How much did you draw from your time growing up there to create the landscape in this novel?
Quite a bit. And, you know, I wrote my first book about the place I had never lived, which was Mississippi. And so I said to myself, okay, the second book, I really want to make it about a place that that I'm familiar with, especially since I'm going to have to be extrapolating 35 years in the future. So, and I also think Dallas is not an illogical place to set a right-wing dystopia. No.
But and then you travel along the way, sort of along following, I guess, in the mold of the great novels in American culture. Mark Twain certainly takes us down the Mississippi, the idea that we have to go somewhere in order for the story to be complete. It's a journey.
Yeah, I think most great novels are journeys of some kind or another.
Your debut novel, Mudbound, won a lot of praise. The story was told through a collection of voices. Was it a relief to you to have only one voice to narrate a story through?
It was, in some ways, yes. You know, it was a deliberate thing. I wanted to get out of the first person, out of the multiple voices, out of the past, out of Mississippi, although I didn't succeed on that one. It showed up again in part four, unexpectedly. But yes, I wanted to do something very different. The only problem with not having six voices, of course, is that when I had six voices, if I got tired of one of them, I could just jump to another. And when you only have one narrative voice, you don't have that option.
There are strong political views that are expressed in this novel. I'm guessing they pretty closely correlate to your views. Were there many surprises for you along the way in writing this book?
Oh, absolutely, because I really had to put my self into the heads of people who are very unlike me, and in the process of really illustrating their views, you know, I was really forced to grapple with a lot of things, and at least to have respect for the views of people who feel very differently from me. And if I have a hope for the book, that's one of my hopes, is that it will encourage that, and because I believe our political discourse has gotten so vitriolic and so extremely polarized, and I tried very hard in this book to look at many issues, faith, abortion, many different issues from multiple sides.
Did you come to a deeper understanding or a different understanding about the mindset of some of the people who might not agree with you?
Yeah, I came to a deeper understanding of it. Not really a different understanding, but I think that I definitely sympathize with people of faith and people who are against abortion. I mean, I understand by writing about them, I came to understand them, I think, much better.
Now, the death penalty has been outlawed in this dystopic Texas. That's interesting.
Yes, well, many people of faith are against the death penalty. I found that, again, that's one of those dichotomies that people feel very differently about. So the future's not all bad. At least we've outlawed the death penalty.
How about in creating a new world for your characters, the idea of the near future? Did you feel, in a sense, liberated, or is that scary somehow?
It was liberating because, you know, it's sort of anyone's guess, right? So unlike with Mudbound, you know, where I was terrified of making a mistake and that the history police would come after me in some sense, with the future, you know, it's pretty wide open. I mean, I did do a great deal of research, but no, it was very liberating. You know, it sort of could go anywhere I wanted, and so that was a very different experience from writing my film.
What kind of research?
Oh my gosh! If you saw my Google searches, you know, it's everything from
I have seen them, but
fundamentalist
I've
ideas.
I've seen them and shared them, in fact.
Fundamentalist ideas of women's wickedness to nuclear, you know, nuclear outcomes to, you know, things about diseases. I mean, you know, so it was a lot of interesting searching.
Your Google searches are available on the Homeland Security webpage. I just thought you should know that. But that's the other side of this. You said you're worried about the history police when you did Mudbound because it was, you know, in a real time and place. On the other hand, when you create a new universe or a new place, you're bound by the rules of that place and somehow have to come back to rules that are not Googleable. Did you find yourself saying, oh, my goodness, I can't do that because I created this in chapter two?
Well, then if you write yourself into a box, then you change it and you write yourself out. You always, as you go further into a novel, you always find yourself inside your own boxes. And sometimes they're pretty solid boxes, but other times, you know, they're permeable and you can change them or change the shape of them. Or I mean, that's just the process.
This novel has also been compared to The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. Are you a reader of this kind of narrative? Is this kind of fiction what you like to read?
I've always loved dystopia, and I would say I've been influenced by Ms. Atwood, but probably by every dystopian writer that I've ever read, you know, from Orwell on down to P.D. James, Children of Men, another book I really admired. I love this kind of book.
Do you consider this science fiction?
No, I consider it, I would say, speculative fiction. I think science fiction is really more about, a lot of it's about the stuff, you know, the gadgets and the spaceships and so forth. I wanted this to be a very recognizable near future, a place that people could envision pretty clearly. And I think science fiction goes much farther out.
This would make a fine movie, don't you think?
It would.
is writing? I want to ask you about writing for print, and why not start out with a screenplay?
You know, I'm a novelist. I really like the craftsmanship of the words is for me a big part of what I do. And yes, I enjoy writing dialogue, but I feel like my best kind of storytelling is through narrative and through a long narrative. So I don't know. I may write a screenplay one day, but for now I'm very content to write fiction.
And what are you writing now?
I'm not writing anything. I'm on book tour, but when I'm done, I'm going to start my third novel.
And?
I'm not talking a whole lot about it yet.
All right.
And it might change my mind, you know, but once I get into it, I will.
All right, Hillary.
Talk about it more.
Well, we will find out more about that the next time. Meanwhile, thanks for talking with us now.
Thank you very much.
Hillary Jordan's new book is called When She Woke, and she's going to be reading from it and signing copies on Sunday at McIntyre's Books in Pittsboro. That's at 2 o'clock. And then again on Monday, December 5th, she's going to be in Chapel Hill at Flyleaf Books, 7 o'clock. For more information, visit algonquin.com. Coming up, a conversation with two legal scholars about same-sex marriage. Stay with us on The State of Things.